were, for the most part, sitting pretty by the end of 2013. The stock market, for example, emerged relatively unscathed from the Great Recession. In October 2007, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, an index of 30 large company stocks, reached a high of 14,198. By March 2009, it had plunged 55%. But by mid-2018, it had passed the 25,000 mark. Trouble was, most Americans had no stocks. In fact, it was estimated nearly 40% of all equities in the stock market were owned by just 1% of Americans. Quickly recovering from the recession's ills was a boon enjoyed mostly by those at the very top of the wealth scale. The rich get richer. On March 2, 2009, the giant insurance company AIG announced it had lost a staggering $62 billion during the last quarter of 2008. The government responded by hastily funneling $30 billion to the firm. Federal officials deemed the company too big to fail, meaning its collapse would do irreparable harm to the nation's economy. 2 weeks later, AIG announced it was paying $450 million in bonuses to the firm's top executives, in part so they wouldn't quit. The outrage was quick and loud. The first thing that would make me feel a little bit better towards them is if they would follow the Japanese example, said Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, and come before the American people and take that deep bow and say, "I'm sorry," and then do either one of two things, resign or go commit suicide. As it turned out, taxpayers invested a total of $182 billion in AIG. The firm eventually restructured, and by 2012, the federal government had recouped the bailout and made a $22.7 billion profit. But the flap became a symbol of deepening divide between America's haves and have-nots. The divide was intensified by the fact that whatever wealth most middle-class families had was in the value of their homes or in retirement savings. When the housing market flopped and the stock market plunged, so did their nest eggs. Median household wealth plunged a whopping 39% between 2007 and 2011. Overall, it is estimated that the bottom 80% of households lost two decades' worth of wealth, a congressional research report concluded in 2012. Worse, the average American couldn't buy more stuff with the money he or she did have. A 2018 study by the Pew Research Center found that despite the low unemployment rate and the steady addition of jobs to the economy from 2010 to 2018, the purchasing power of the average American's wages, adjusted for inflation, hadn't budged since 1978. The wealthy also took big hits when the stock market dropped. But they had the resources to hold on to their holdings and even buy more stocks when prices were low. That meant they more than made up for their losses when the market recovered. By 2017, it was estimated that just 1% of U.S. households controlled 40% of the country's wealth, the highest level in almost 60 years. But the defenders of the 1%ers, in 2018, that meant those who earned at least $481,000 a year, were quick to point out that the very wealthy also paid 39% of all federal income taxes, contributed more than 30% of all charitable giving, and were three times as likely to work more than 50 hours a week as anyone else. If those people could camp out in the park all day, a wealthy businessman told the New York Times in 2012, referring to anti-rich protesters, why aren't they out looking for a job? Why are they blaming others? The blame game. On September 17, 2011, a group of about 1,000 people showed up in New York City's financial district and set up camp in a park. The Occupy Wall Street movement, conceived and organized through the Internet and social media, was designed mainly to protest the social and economic inequities that had grown during the Great Recession. "We are the 99%, became the movement's rallying slogan, and allied demonstrations were held in more than 70 other cities around the country. The occupiers' camp was cleared out by police in mid-November, and the movement rather quickly faded from the public eye. But if nothing else, Occupy Wall Street cemented the terms 1%ers and the other 99% in America's political lexicon and fostered debate about economic inequality. We can either settle for a country where a shrinking number of people do really well while a growing number of Americans barely get by, President Obama said in his January 2012 State of the Union address, or we can restore an economy where everyone gets a fair shot, and everyone does their fair share, and everyone plays by the same set of rules. Deciding who drew up the rules, however, became the country's biggest and most bitter bone of contention in the years ahead. Detroit. It began as a small fur trading post and rose to become the nation's fourth largest city and center of the automobile universe, and eventually the poster child for urban blight. Founded in 1701, Detroit exploded in size and prominence at the beginning of the 20th century, when Henry Ford and other car manufacturers located there. The city attracted tens of thousands of unskilled workers, many of them immigrants or African Americans from the South, who were seeking stable jobs with decent wages and benefits. By 1950, the population reached 1.9 million, and Detroit was synonymous with automaking. But increasing competition from foreign car companies, over-reliance on a single industry, and years of incompetent and sometimes corrupt leadership took their toll. By 2010, the city had shrunk to 714,000. Entire blocks consisted of abandoned buildings. City services had deteriorated to the point that police response to emergency calls could take 45 minutes. And no U.S. city was hit harder by the Great Recession. Billions of dollars in debt, Detroit sought bankruptcy protection in federal court in July 2013, the largest American city ever to do so. 5 years later, the city's core was being revitalized with new investment. Its $19 billion debt had been restructured, and deserted neighborhoods were being re-inhabited. But it still had a long way to go. Chapter 23. Reforming Healthcare is No Tea Party. In this chapter, electing and re-electing a new kind of president. Boiling over with the Tea Party. Getting sick over health care, battling over the budget. Although the Founding Fathers warned against them, political parties have been a prominent feature of American politics since the 1790s. Generally, two major parties have been all Americans can stomach at any one time. But every once in a while, a third party or political movement has risen temporarily to prominence, if not lasting influence. In this chapter, I look at the rise of one such movement. I also detail an ambitious and ultra-controversial effort to improve America's health, or at least its health care, and chronicle the brief shutdown of the federal government. Oh, and I throw in a couple of presidential elections, no extra charge. The Great Presidential Race of 2008. A U.S. presidential race, with no incumbent chief executive or vice president running, hadn't occurred since 1928. So, when a wide-open field presented itself in the 2008 contest, it attracted a veritable herd of candidates. In an effort to enhance their voters' clout in selecting the party's nominees, a host of states raced to move their primaries to the front of the pack. As a result, six states held caucuses or primary elections before the end of January, and 30 more by mid-February. The earlier primaries meant an earlier start to serious campaigning. By the spring of 2008, Democratic presidential wannabes had participated in 26 debates or forums, Republicans in 21. In early March, U.S. Senator John McCain of Arizona sewed up the GOP nomination. It capped a startling comeback for McCain, whose campaign had been broken and almost done just a few months before. In the Democratic race, Senators Barack Obama of Illinois and Hillary Clinton of New York, the former First Lady, ran away from the rest of the field by mid-February. That guaranteed the 2008 general election would be the first of its kind, with either the first woman presidential nominee by a major U.S. political party or the first African American. But if they outdistanced the rest of the field, they couldn't outdistance each other, trading primary victories in key states throughout the spring. Finally, Obama clinched the nomination in early June. Obama selected Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, a well-known political veteran, as his vice presidential running mate. But McCain surprised everyone by picking Sarah Palin, the obscure first-term governor of Alaska. At various times, Palin both energized the McCain campaign and acted as a distraction. Obama versus McCain. The two top-of-the-ticket candidates offered Americans one of the most disparate choices in U.S. history. At 47, Obama would be the fourth youngest president ever. At 72, McCain would be the oldest. McCain was a naval veteran of 22 years, 5.5 years as a prisoner during the Vietnam War, and a fourth-term senator. Obama hadn't served in the military and was a first-term senator. Obama was the son of a white American woman and a black Kenyan man. McCain had an ancestor who had served on the staff of George Washington. Obama liked to deliver electrifying speeches before huge crowds. McCain preferred chatting with small groups in informal settings. The two also had widely differing views on nearly every issue: the war in Iraq, health care, taxes, energy, and the environment. Obama fought charges that he was a socialist in progressives' clothing. McCain fought charges that he represented 4 more years of policies identical to those of the highly unpopular Bush. Obama's historic victory. Obama held a narrow lead through most of the summer. As election day grew closer, the country's staggering economy came to dominate the campaign, and voters decided Obama was better equipped to deal with it. It was a convincing victory. Obama carried states no Democratic candidate had carried in 30 years. He also galvanized young voters and minorities to vote in record numbers. Obama's campaign leaned heavily on new technology and techniques, such as sending Election Day voting reminders to cell phones and using websites to raise money and organize grassroots efforts. If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer, Obama said during an election night celebration in Chicago. In 1858, buying and selling human beings was legal in America. In 1958, discrimination based on race was widespread. In 2008, an African American was elected 44th President of the United States. The country had come a long way. But as Obama would find out, it also had a long way to go. Calling the President a liar. On September 9, 2009, 232 days after taking office, Obama was addressing a joint session of Congress about his proposed health care reform program. when the president said that despite claims to the contrary, the plan would not cover illegal immigrants, Representative Joe Wilson of South Carolina, a Republican, pointed at Obama and shouted, "You lie!" twice. Remember, the incident showed just how nasty the partisan split in the nation's capital had become. But it belied just how busy Congress really was during the first 2 years of Obama's administration. Congress lifted a ban on homosexuals serving in the military, approved the new arms control treaty with Russia, overhauled regulations for the financial industry, enacted a sweeping health care plan, called for pay equity for women, approved more regulation of the tobacco industry, confirmed the nominations to the U.S. Supreme Court of two women, one of them Hispanic, and approved a mammoth economic stimulus program and an even bigger tax cut package. It did so through Democratic dominance. Along with electing Obama, American voters in 2008 had increased the Democrats' control of the House of Representatives by 21 seats from 2006 and gave Democrats a 16-seat edge in the Senate. Simply put, the majority party did pretty much what it wanted. But American voters can be a fickle bunch, and not everyone was happy with all that congressional activity. Going to a Tea Party. One of the things that stuck in the craws of many Americans in the Great Recession was the series of decisions by the Bush and Obama administrations, abetted by Congress, to provide hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars to huge banks and corporations. They weren't buying the rationale that temporary aid to the companies would provide economic stability and combat unemployment. The average guy was worried about losing his job, paying his mortgage, and sending his kids to college, and without any government bailout. Moreover, many were weary of what they regarded as too much federal interference in matters they thought were best left to local or state decisions, such as education or voter registration. I worked hard, and I went for the American dream, and I did okay, actor John Ratzenberger told a crowd of 5,000 on the state capitol steps in Sacramento, California, in April 2009. But now I'm confused. Why does the government want to take my money and give it to people who don't work? Ratzenberger, who was best known for portraying an obnoxious mailman on the TV show Cheers, was taking part in one of about 750 rallies throughout the country. Although partly financed by Republican-affiliated groups and individuals and promoted by conservative media, the rally's organizers insisted they were part of a nonpartisan, loosely organized grassroots effort that became known as the Tea Party Movement. The movement took its name from the 1773 incident in Boston when American colonists dumped British tea into the harbor. See Chapter 4. It sprang up in February 2009, fueled by protests from Seattle to New York about various issues, and it was given national impetus after a Chicago TV reporter named Rick Santelli launched a tirade about the government bailing out people whose house mortgage deals had soured. Santelli suggested it was time for a Chicago Tea Party, and the Tea Party name stuck. The movement wasn't a formal political party, and members prided themselves that it had no leaders or formal central structure. Its message generally focused on economic issues more than social ones. Tea Partiers wanted to reduce the federal budget deficit, cut taxes, reduce government spending, and require strict faithfulness to the U.S. Constitution. Through 2009, Tea Party devotees focused mostly on protest rallies and recruiting new members, and were generally viewed as a minor ingredient in the country's political stew. By 2010, that view changed considerably. Taking over the House. In January 2010, A special election was held in Massachusetts to fill the U.S. Senate seat of Ted Kennedy, who had died in 2009. Scott Brown, a relatively obscure Republican state legislator, squared off against the state's Democratic Attorney General, Martha Coakley. With the state's Democratic voters outnumbering Republicans by a 3-to-1 margin, Coakley was a big favorite. But Brown pulled off a huge upset, becoming the first GOP senator elected in Massachusetts in 38 years. Remember, it was a harbinger of things to come. A perfect storm of elements converged on Democrats. Unemployment rates remained high, despite federal bailouts of banks and big businesses. Many Americans found the new national health care plan confusing, and others just didn't like it. And Obama was the target of persistent, if ridiculous, rumors that he was born in Kenya and thus not constitutionally eligible to be president. In addition, Democrats had won many congressional seats in 2006 and 2008 in districts that contained lots of Republican and independent voters who were ready for a change. The hundreds of Tea Party groups that had formed in 2009 also played roles. The groups raised money and organized get-out-the-vote efforts. They also endorsed candidates in Republican primaries, often against establishment candidates who had the official blessing of GOP leaders. How much substantive impact the movement had in the general election has been dissected and debated in various academic studies. But it certainly galvanized the electorate. A November Gallup poll found that 73% of Americans thought the Tea Party energized more people into getting involved in the political process, although 55% also thought it deepened partisan divisions. Larger percentages of white, senior citizen, and self-described conservative voters turned out in 2010 than in 2008, and they tended to vote Republican. Worse for Democrats, 63% of voters describing themselves as independents voted for GOP candidates in 2010, as opposed to just 49% in 2008. Remember, the result was a Republican landslide. The party gained 63 seats and a majority in the House, the biggest gain by either party in a midterm election since 1938. The GOP also picked up 6 seats in the Senate and captured a record 680 state legislative seats. "Tonight, there's a Tea Party tidal wave," said Rand Paul of Kentucky, one of the Tea Party-backed Senate winners. "And we're sending a message." But the movement became a victim of its own success. Mainstream politicians, particularly Republicans, began portraying themselves as Tea Party leaders even while ignoring key movement principles, such as cutting government spending and trimming the federal deficit. By late 2015, polls showed American support of the Tea Party movement had dropped from 32% in 2010 to 17%. Even so, the movement's distrust of big government, distaste for traditional candidates, and dislike of party leaders setting the party's agenda found their way into the roots of the Donald J. Trump presidential campaign that won the White House in 2016. Cutting taxes by compromising. Taxes, American journalist Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. noted in 1904, are the price we pay for a civilized society. But in 2010, U.S. politicians were more interested in reviving the economy than in civilizing society. So, with a set of 10-year-old temporary federal tax cuts ready to expire on January 1, 2011, and Republicans ready to take control of the House of Representatives 2 days after that, President Obama was ready to make a deal. On December 6th, the president and Republican lawmakers agreed on an $858 billion plan that gave each side some of what it wanted. In addition to extending tax cuts for 2 years, The package continued lower tax rates on capital gains and dividends, expanded unemployment insurance coverage, cut Social Security tax deductions from paychecks, and extended tax credits for college tuition and business investment in research and development. Supporters said the plan would save jobs, give families more spending money, and generally goose the economy. The bill passed the Senate on a bipartisan 81-19 vote. But Democrats in the House balked, characterizing it as a huge giveaway to the super rich. They tried to limit the tax cuts to households making less than $250,000 and then to less than $1 million. The Senate rejected both efforts. Eventually, the House approved the package on a 277-148 vote, with 139 Democrats joining 138 Republicans in the majority. Many of the Democrats who voted for it acknowledged the reality that Republicans would be taking over the House and feared any bill the Republicans proposed then would be unlikely to include jobless benefits or the payroll tax cut. Obama signed the bill on December 17th at a ceremony attended by the Republican, but not Democratic, congressional leaders. "I'm hopeful that we might refresh the American people's faith in the capability of their leaders to govern," he said, with no apparent trace of irony. A Gulf Full of Oil. The oil spill seemed minimal, at first. The day after the April 20, 2010 explosion in the Gulf of Mexico of an oil rig owned by British Petroleum, BP, officials were keeping their fingers crossed that most of the leaking oil would burn up and that the 11 missing rig crew members would be found. No such luck. The 11 men were never found. The well gushed oil, 210 million gallons, for nearly 3 months. Marine life died, the land and sea were polluted, and the Gulf Coast region's economy was walloped. All in all, it turned out to be the worst marine oil spill in history. A federal investigation concluded that BP and two contractors, Halliburton and Transocean, had cut construction costs on the rig, and also that government officials had been too prone to accept assurances from the oil industry that things were being done safely. BP pled guilty to 11 felony counts related to the workers' deaths and paid more than $53 billion in fines and costs for cleaning up the mess and indemnifying individuals and businesses. Lurching toward health care. One of Obama's biggest first-term goals was to find a cure for America's healthcare system. The president and many others contended that soaring healthcare costs were bankrupting individuals, shutting down small businesses, and crippling corporations. Getting well, or trying not to get sick in the first place, was sucking up larger and larger percentages of the nation's economy, which wasn't feeling too good itself. Revamping the healthcare system had been tried by other presidents as far back as Theodore Roosevelt. The last Democratic president before Obama, Bill Clinton, had tried and failed in 1993. But Obama was buoyed by the relative success of a Massachusetts plan that had been signed into law in 2006 by Governor Mitt Romney, a Republican. The system required everyone to have health insurance and provided aid for those who couldn't afford it. With his public approval rating above 60% and comfortable Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate, Obama prodded and cajoled a sweeping health care reform bill through Congress, signing it into law on March 23, 2010. Not a single Republican in either House voted for it. The 906-page Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010, commonly known as Obamacare, was humongous in size and excruciating in detail. Basically, and a bit simplistically, here's some of what it was supposed to do. Allow individuals to keep their current health plan if they chose to do so, and allow parents to add children up to the age of 26 to their plans. Prohibit insurance companies from dropping customers who got sick and from denying them coverage because of pre-existing conditions. Require healthcare providers to provide preventative services, such as wellness exams and tests for specific problems, such as prostate and breast cancer. Require everyone to buy some kind of health insurance, known as the individual mandate, by March 31, 2014, or face a financial penalty, and require employers with more than 49 employees to provide a health insurance plan. Remember, at the heart of the plan was the idea that if everyone had to buy insurance, a lot of young, healthy people wouldn't use the health system and thus would help defray the costs of those who did. States were allowed to set up their own insurance exchanges to match people up with plans. If they chose not to, their residents could use a federally run exchange. The law also required states to expand their Medicaid programs, which provide health care for low-income and disabled people, to help those who needed financial assistance in buying insurance. The feds would pay for all the expanded Medicaid costs for 3 years, and 90% thereafter. It represents a major step forward toward giving Americans with insurance and those without a sense of security when it comes to their health care, Obama said while signing the act into law. What it gave opponents was political heartburn. Critics said Obamacare would drive thousands of small companies out of business because they couldn't afford to provide health insurance for their workers. It was too complex, they said, would cost state governments millions of dollars in Medicaid payments, and was un-American in forcing people to buy something, whether they wanted it or not. Polls showed that more than half of Americans disliked Obamacare within a week of it becoming law, in large part because it was so confusingly complicated. One thing all Republicans agree on is we think Obamacare is the worst piece of legislation in 50 years, said Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. Every Republican thinks it was a huge mistake and would like to get rid of it. Republicans tried. The GOP-controlled House of Representatives voted more than 60 times to strip the health care plan of funding, suspend major portions of it, or repeal it altogether. Each time, they were blocked by the Democratic-controlled Senate. In July 2017, after Republicans had narrowly wrested control of the Senate in the 2014 elections, three GOP senators joined all 48 Democrats and independents in defeating yet another repeal effort. While Congress was persistently but ineptly trying to settle the program's future, other Obamacare foes had taken a different approach. Courting the Supreme Court. In January 2011, the state of Florida sued to block the health care plan from taking effect on the grounds the federal government didn't have the constitutional authority to require individuals to buy health insurance. Both a trial court judge and an appellate court sided with Florida, whose cause was eventually joined by 25 other states. Similar suits followed with varying degrees of success before various appeals courts. Finally, in December, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to decide the issue. In March 2012, justices listened to 3 days of argument over the act's constitutionality. The prevailing public opinion, both expert and novice, was that the five conservative justices on the 9-member court would overturn the law. That view was buttressed at one point in the proceedings when Justice Antonin Scalia sarcastically asked if Congress could force people to buy broccoli as well as health insurance. Remember, but the prevailing opinion was proved wrong on June 26th when Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's four liberal justices in a decision that gave Obamacare supporters most, but not all, of what they wanted. The majority ruled that mandating individuals to buy health insurance or face a financial penalty was essentially just a form of taxation, which Congress had the power to do. States whose elected leaders opposed the law, however, did get a consolation prize. They could refuse to accept additional federal funds to expand their Medicaid programs to cover low-income people who weren't eligible for current Medicaid help but couldn't afford to buy health insurance. A stumbling start. The court had ruled, but the Obamacare battles were far from over. For one thing, different states took far different approaches to implementing the plan, which began on October 1, 2013. Although the plan originally envisioned each state setting up its own exchange where its residents could buy insurance, only 14 did so. That left it up to the federal government to set up a national exchange. And the decision is, the fate of Obamacare wasn't the only big ruling to come from the closely divided Supreme Court during the first years of the 21st century. Among the others, Citizens United versus Federal Elections Commission. On January 21, 2010, the court ruled on a 5-4 vote that the government couldn't prohibit or limit corporations and labor unions from spending on political campaigns and causes. The ruling overturned not only federal election laws, but also two decisions by earlier Supreme Courts. The decision was a huge impetus to the blossoming of super PACs, which were huge political action committees that raised hundreds of millions of dollars for candidates, but made it difficult, if not impossible, to trace precisely the sources of the contributions. Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder. On June 25, 2013, on a 5-4 vote, the court struck down a major part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The decision allowed states to make changes in their voting laws, such as requiring photo identification, without federal approval. United States versus Windsor. The next day, the court ruled that married couples of the same sex were entitled to federal benefits, and cleared the way for same-sex marriages in California. Both decisions were on, surprise, 5-4 votes, but different combinations of justices voted with the majority in each case. While exchanges in some states, such as California and New York, performed reasonably well, others had technical glitches, and the launch of the federal exchange was little short of a disaster. People spent hours vainly trying to even sign into the system, let alone navigate the labyrinthine application process. By mid-November, only 106,000 people had signed up of the 7 million plus the Obama administration estimated might be covered. Remember, in addition, 25 states decided not to accept additional federal money for extending their Medicaid programs to cover residents who made too much money to qualify for existing aid, but too little to afford health insurance. The result was that many Americans faced the choice of going without coverage or moving to another state. To make matters worse, it turned out an Obama promise that people with existing policies could keep them wasn't so. Thousands of policies were canceled by insurance companies because their benefits didn't comply with Obamacare requirements. That resulted in many people facing higher premiums for new policies they didn't want in the first place. All this infuriated voters and delighted Obamacare opponents. In the November 2014 elections, Republicans swept to their largest congressional majorities since 1928. And won numerous gubernatorial and state legislative seats. Along with concerns about illegal immigration, dissatisfaction with Obamacare was often cited by voters as a key motivator for voting GOP. And as it turned out, the legal battles weren't over after all. In June 2014, the Supreme Court voted 5-4 to strike down an Obamacare provision that required private companies to offer birth control insurance coverage to employees even if the company's owners objected to it on religious grounds. Clinging to its legislative life. Still, Obamacare survived through 2018. The National Center for Health Statistics estimated that about 20 million Americans who had lacked health insurance in 2010 now had some form of coverage, although that still left an estimated 28.6 million with no coverage. After soaring price increases in 2016 and 2017, the rate of cost increases for health coverage seemed to have slowed. Even so, abolishing Obamacare remained a Republican priority. Obama's Republican successor in the White House, Donald J. Trump, was an ardent and vocal opponent of the program. With his backing, Congress approved ending the requirement that taxpayers who decline to seek insurance be fined an average of $695 per year. Trump's administration also announced it would not try to enforce the Act's requirement that health insurance companies provide coverage to consumers with pre-existing health conditions. As a result of these and other administrative actions, it was estimated that the number of Americans without health insurance increased by about 3 million during Trump's first year in office. Re-electing Obama in 2012. The economy was still shaky. The war in Afghanistan was entering its second decade. Polls showed fewer than half of Americans liked his health care plan, and fewer than half liked the job he was doing. Still, Barack Obama wanted to extend his lease on the White House. Even without all the problems, he was bucking the odds, if you believed his historical precedent. Only once had three consecutive presidents served two full terms, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, and that was nearly two centuries before. The Challenger. Mitt Romney had finished second to John McCain in the 2008 GOP presidential derby and had a yen to do better in 2012. The son of former Michigan Governor Hugh Romney, who had also run for president, Mitt, that was his middle name, his first name was Willard, held both law and business degrees from Harvard. His career had included being governor of Massachusetts for a term, running the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City in 2002, and operating Bain Capital, a private equity company that bought businesses, tried to increase their market value, and then sold them again. Romney, 65, outlasted a small army of other GOP candidates in the primaries. By May, the last two challengers, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, dropped out. Romney chose Paul Ryan, a Wisconsin congressman who was considered a whiz at economics and the federal budget, as his vice presidential running mate. The race. The campaign centered mainly on domestic issues, such as how best to create jobs, Obama's health care plan, which hadn't gone into effect yet, and how to balance the needs of programs such as Social Security and Medicare against the growing national debt. Obama and Romney spent a total of more than $2 billion, the overwhelming majority, as much as 80% according to some studies, of it going for ads that ripped into each other's characters and often exaggerated their stands on issues. Obama led in most polls through the summer, albeit narrowly. But Romney briefly took the lead in early October after a nationally televised debate in Denver in which Obama appeared tired, whiny, and a bit bored. In two subsequent debates, however, the president acquitted himself much better. The results. Obama won fairly easily. He took 332 of the 538 electoral votes and 51.4% of the popular vote. The president lost only two states, North Carolina and Indiana, that he had won in 2008. Obama crushed Romney among minority voters, winning 93% of African American votes, 71% of Hispanic, and 73% of Asian Americans. He also won big among voters under the age of 40 and those making less than $50,000 a year. All those margins reflected a deepening political division among Americans along racial, economic, and generational lines. Democracy in a nation of 300 million can be noisy and messy and complicated, Obama said on election night. We have our own opinions, and when we go through tough times, when we make big decisions as a country, it necessarily stirs passions, stirs up controversy. That won't change after tonight, and it shouldn't. And it didn't. Meanwhile, back at the budget. Despite all the warm and fuzzy talk about bipartisan cooperation after reaching a compromise on tax cuts at the end of 2010, America began a 3-year pinball game of careening from one federal fiscal crisis to another. At their essence, the fights boiled down to some deep ideological differences between Republican and Democratic lawmakers. Republicans generally favored cutting taxes, including those at the highest income levels, and limiting government spending. That approach, they reasoned, would leave more money in the hands of individuals and businesses, which in turn would create more jobs. Democrats argued that extending tax cuts to the wealthy was less important than having enough revenue to ensure aid to those Americans at the bottom of the economic ladder. Add to that the fact that Republicans controlled the House and Democrats the Senate and White House. Then buckle your seatbelt for the great budget battles of 2011 through 2013. Hitting the debt ceiling. The federal debt ceiling is the highest amount the U.S. Treasury can borrow without congressional approval. Formalized by Congress in 1917, the ceiling has been repeatedly and routinely raised by Congress with little or no debate. That changed, however, in 2011, when Republican lawmakers demanded federal spending cuts in return for raising the debt ceiling. The Treasury Department warned that if the ceiling wasn't raised by August 2nd, the United States would default on financial debts it had already incurred. The only time in U.S. history that ever happened was in the War of 1812, when the British burned down the Treasury. After weeks of arguing, the two parties reached a deal, and Obama signed it into law on August 2nd. Remember, the deal raised the debt ceiling by $900 billion. But, and it was a big but, if the two sides failed to find a way to cut $1.2 trillion from the national debt, the agreement called for automatic across-the-board cuts to take place on January 1, 2013. The looming cuts amounted to $1.2 trillion in reduced spending over 10 years. That was relatively peanuts compared to the size of the national debt, which in late 2013 was about $17 trillion, about 2.5 times what it had been in 2003. But it was a fortune if you depended on the government programs that would be chopped. Most members of both parties didn't favor across-the-board budget cuts, called sequestration, because it would include programs and projects each side supported. The hope was that sequestration would put burrs under both party saddles and get them to find some long-range solutions. But Congress turned out to have a pretty thick hide. The deal did spur the credit rating agency Standard & Poor's to downgrade America's credit rating for the first time ever. S&P officials said they just didn't trust Obama and Congress to come up with a stable long-term plan. The downgrade triggered a hefty, if temporary, plunge in the stock market. Driving off the fiscal cliff. In February 2012, Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, warned that America faced a massive fiscal cliff of large spending cuts and tax increases. His reference was to the fact that the tax cuts Obama and Congress had compromised on in late 2010 were set to expire on January 1, 2013. At the same time, the budget cuts the two sides had agreed to postpone in August 2011 were poised to kick in, that was a surefire recipe for a giant economic stomachache. So everyone sat down to squabble, negotiate. Democrats wanted to eliminate tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. Republicans wanted to continue the cuts for everyone and pay for it by cutting deeper into social programs. After months of rhetorical battle, they reached a deal in the wee morning hours of January 1, 2013. The tax cuts were extended for Americans making less than $400,000 a year, and the budget cuts were kicked down the road again until March 2013. But despite further negotiations, Congress failed to head off the budget cuts, which kicked in on schedule. Shutting down the government. Meanwhile, Treasury officials warned that the country would hit its debt ceiling again in mid-October. And throughout the summer, Congress also failed to agree on a spending plan to keep the federal government running. So on October 1, 2013, the government shut down. About 800,000 federal employees were told to stay home. National parks and monuments were closed. People relying on the approval of various federal agencies for loans, medical procedures, and other services were out of luck. After 16 days of rhetorically rattling sabers and studying public opinion polls, Congress's approval rating dropped to an abysmal 9%. The two sides agreed to fund the government until January 2014 and suspend the debt ceiling until February. In mid-December, a shockingly subdued Congress approved a federal spending plan designed to last through September 2015. The plan eliminated some of the sequestration budget cuts and helped ensure against another embarrassing government shutdown in 2014, an election year. The wheels of government began, creakily and crankily, to turn once more. Chapter 24. America Disagrees with Itself. In this chapter, electing a new kind of president, sorting out foreign friends from foes, getting shot, getting high, and dying. Weathering the weather. With apologies to Charles Dickens, it was neither the best nor worst of times. It was, well, pretty mixed. Crime rates were generally down, yet it seemed not a day went by without a violent act dominating the news. Unemployment was at historic low levels, and taxes had been cut. But the median household income was basically unchanged from two decades before. Abroad, America quarreled with longtime friends and canoodled with longtime foes. And at home, Americans seemed divided on every issue except which direction the sun came up in the morning, and even that seemed debatable. This chapter focuses on the uncertainties and divisions that gripped the country as the 2020s loomed. Oh, and there is also a really different kind of U.S. president in there somewhere. Trumped. Hillary Clinton was supposed to win the 2016 presidential race. Virtually every pre-election survey said so. After all, she had been a fixture in the national spotlight since serving as first lady to her husband Bill in the early 1990s. Since then, she had been a U.S. senator from New York, a strong 2008 Democratic presidential candidate, and Secretary of State under President Obama. Her GOP opponent, meanwhile, was a flamboyant New York real estate billionaire and reality television star, whose most notable catchphrase was, "You're fired," and who had never held, nor even run, for elected office. In fact, of the 17 Republican presidential hopefuls who entered the race, Donald J. Trump was considered by one Washington Post pundit in mid-2015 to be slightly more likely to become our next president than he is to be the first person to set foot on the surface of a planet circling Alpha Centauri. A late 2015 poll of Republican voters reported that 76% absolutely or probably would not vote for him. Guess what? Trump 1. Actually, he lost the popular vote by a whopping 2.8 million votes. But he carried 30 states, including all of the South and most of the Midwest, winning 304 electoral votes to Clinton's 227. Trump thus became the fifth U.S. president to lose the popular vote and yet win the White House. How he won left political scientists scratching their heads. In fiery rallies that often resembled religious revival meetings, Trump promised to make America great again by banning Muslims, building a wall along the Mexican border, stopping unfair foreign trade deals, and repealing the 2010 national health care law referred to as Obamacare. He belittled opponents' physical appearance and personalities, slammed the news media as liars, and never apologized for anything. But what resonated most with voters was his promise as a Washington outsider to drain the swamp of special interest influence and politics-as-usual government. He eschewed political correctness and said what he thought as soon as he thought it, and sometimes, Foe said, before he thought it. Clinton, meanwhile, ran a lackluster campaign in which she struck many voters as cold and aloof, and part of a government system they felt had let them down and left them behind. There was also a controversy over whether she illegally used a private email server while Secretary of State, an allegation that triggered an FBI probe that was closed, then reopened, and then closed again days before the election. The episode diverted at least some negative media attention away from Trump. The truth was that most voters didn't like either of them. Clinton's disapproval rating on Election Day was 54%, Trump's 61%. But Trump's appeal as someone who would shake things up was enough to give him 7 of the 11 most closely contested states, thus delivering the most shocking upset in modern presidential elections. Getting to know a new kind of president. Depending on whom you asked, he was the best president since Lincoln or the worst president ever. But there was no denying Donald J. Trump was a very different kind of chief executive. Rather than vigorously contest or beg forgiveness for political hot potatoes that ranged from paying a pornographic film actress to keep quiet about an affair to using adroit legal maneuvers to avoid paying taxes on millions of dollars in income, Trump variously ignored, denied, and/or dismissed the controversies, and then changed the subject. As with all presidents, he exaggerated, hyperbolized, and outright lied. But few, if any, of his predecessors had major news organizations keeping daily track of what they contended were examples of Trump stretching or breaking the truth. The Washington Post, for example, reported Trump had averaged 5 false or misleading statements per day during his first 9 months in office. None of it seemed to faze the president or his followers. "I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose voters," he said during a campaign rally before the election. He was right, at least about those who voted for him. Polls showed that after 18 months in office, almost 60% of American adults disapproved of Trump's administration. But a staggering 90% of Republican voters liked what he was doing, and that was enough to ensure that the Republican-controlled Congress paid attention to what the president wanted, at least most of the time. Cutting taxes and picking judges. What Trump wanted had been laid out during his campaign, and he managed to deliver on at least some promises. His call for a complete rejection of Obamacare was stymied. See Chapter 23 for details. His promised Mexico border wall was sidetracked, and his plan to rebuild America's infrastructure remained dormant during his first 2 years. But he was successful in making things tougher on both legal and illegal immigrants. See Chapter 25. His administration rolled back or canceled dozens of federal government regulations and programs concerning business and financial institution oversight, the environment, and social service programs. And he scored in two other areas that were high priorities: tax cuts and conservative control of the U.S. Supreme Court. In December 2017, congressional Republicans pushed through, and Trump signed into law, a bill that featured hefty reductions in business taxes, lower personal income tax rates, changes in income tax calculations, and even permission for oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Nonpartisan studies concluded that most of the bill's benefits would accrue to corporations and the wealthiest individuals and would more than triple the federal government's debt. But Trump and other supporters contended it would more than pay for itself in the long run by stimulating the economy through job creation and investment in business and industry expansion. It was basically the supply-side economics argument, also known as trickle-down, that President Reagan had used during the 1980s. While economists argued about the tax bill's merits, Trump had more immediately measurable success when the Senate narrowly confirmed his appointments to two seats in the 9-member U.S. Supreme Court. The confirmations of Neil Gorsuch in 2017